Any part of the world.
Good evening. Good evening, everyone. Hello.
Go for it.
Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. I'm David Alkeck. I'm the president of this august body. And we welcome you. Any new visitors? And how did you hear about us?
On nextdoor.com.
Next door neighbor?
No, next door. It's that
nextdoor.com. Oh, yeah. Anybody else?
Radio?
Yes, ma'am. How did you hear about it?
From another group that I attend. I think it's on Saturday evenings. They
Yeah.
Great. Well, welcome, and we hope you come back. This is our last meeting or lecture of the spring semester. We're going to take off for the summer, as we usually do, and reconvene in September. We're already starting to fill up with some talks for that. A few little housekeeping things. Make sure you take care of your bill. Don't leave us with it. We don't have a lot of money. Speaking of money, don't forget to pay your entry fee to David Drum over here, our treasurer. Okay. If there's no other announcements, I'll just go ahead and introduce our speaker. Dr. Robert Hunt was born in Dallas, and after attending schools in Austin and Richardson, he majored in history at the University of Texas in Austin, Hook'em Horns. Completed a Master of Theology at Perkins, and then taught at the Seminary of Theology in Malaysia. He was a participant in the current Malay translation of the Bible. He received a PhD in history from the University of Malaya in 1993. Dr. Hunt has taught world religions at the Trinity Theological College. He was pastor of the English-speaking United Methodist Church of Vienna and an adjunct professor at Webster University in Vienna in religious and international studies. He is the author of numerous books and articles, some of which have to do with the Muslim religion and culture and Malaysia. Dr. Hunt is presently director of Global Theological Education at the Perkins School of Theology at SMU. And he will talk to us tonight on ways of knowing what there is to be known. That's very good. A reconsideration of science and religion. We all need to know that. So without any further ado, Dr. Hunt.
You're on.
No, okay.
Well, are you? Let's see.
I didn't do anything.
You're on.
You can hear me.
Yep, you're right.
Okay, thank you all very much for the invitation. This is something that has interested me for the last number of years. It happens that these are issues that animate some of the folks in the theology school where I teach, but which also have a lot to do with our understanding of culture and cultural difference. So, in a certain sense, I'm going to treat science and religion as two different cultures, maybe, as we look at them. So, I'll just proceed, and hopefully we'll have time for a Q&A. Did we do that? Yeah?
Yeah, okay.
When considering the relationship between science and religion, we have to recognize that the fundamental question is not the existence of God. It's the question of how we know anything at all about reality. From the beginning of the Enlightenment until the present day, we have been trying to distinguish between what constitutes physics and what constitutes metaphysics, and which is credible, or whether both are credible, or either are credible. much of the 19th and 20th century, it seemed that physics, or science more generally, was gradually excluding metaphysics and thus religion as a serious way of knowing reality. There was, however, a shift in the middle of the last century, the 20th century, when it became clear that the universe we know of had begun with the Big Bang. This had a big impact on me because I was an astronomy major at UT at the time, and in fact, my supervisor, the head of the department, was Robert Jastrow. And this is a quote from Robert Jastrow that's quite famous. When it became clear that the Big Bang was it, right, there was no steady-state universe, etc., Jastrow said, "At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance, he is about to conquer the highest peak, and as he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." Now, since that time, numerous efforts have been made by cosmologists to get around this apparent impasse, to find a way to describe reality that does not leave a mystery at the beginning of time. Adam Frank, a much more contemporary cosmologist, gives an excellent summary of these attempts in his book, About Time, Cosmology and Culture in the Twilight of the Big Bang. He says, quote, "The Big Bang is all but dead, and we do not know now what will replace it," which seems to be very much the scientific consensus. So the basis for Jastrow's comments has been deeply problematized by advances in both astronomical observation and theories seeking to unify relativity theory and quantum theory. Yet these theories also appear to be both mutually exclusive and currently untestable. So while the phrase, right, Frank's phrase, "we do not yet know what will replace it," can be read as a confidence that we will someday know something, it may also be read as leaving room for religion as a way of knowing. What has changed very dramatically, I think, between the time of Jastrow and the current time of Frank is the rise of a vigorous scientism. Jastrow and other scientists who believe that a contemporary cosmology allowed for metaphysics are dismissed with the argument that only the scientific method provides a legitimate way of knowing reality. Only science is sufficiently rigorous in providing content, coherent, testable models that can be taken seriously as a way of knowing what there is. One of my colleagues at SMU, Stephen Sekula, who worked on the Higgs boson project, says, quote, "Mathematics is the language of nature, and it is only a short step further to equate nature with reality and say that what cannot be described mathematically cannot be taken seriously as real." And that is a quite common viewpoint among cosmologists, at least. I think maybe most scientists. Scientism does not claim to have all the answers, but it does claim to possess the only legitimate means of finding those answers. And that includes questions of ethics and meaning that have traditionally been reserved for religion and philosopher. And if you want to see this in the popular works, you might look at the work of Michael Shermer, who writes a column for Scientific American, Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss, and many others are contemporary examples of this scientism. From this perspective, the mere fact that we don't know what will replace the Big Bang, or even that some contemporary theories are not yet fully coherent, in fact, none of them are fully coherent, and cannot be tested, doesn't justify turning to metaphysics or religion. At least they don't make a vague appeal to mystery and continue to use rigorous mathematical proofs. So, yeah, we may not know everything, but your way of knowing it's certainly not going to work. As Steve Weinstein suggested in his book, Dreams of a Final Theory, and Carl Sagan echoed in his Science, a Light in a Demon-Haunted World, science doesn't need to provide answers now, or even the promise of an answer in the near future. Its pursuit lifts human life from the realm of farce to that of tragedy. That's a quote from Weinstein. Put another way, science gives life authentic meaning precisely in its rejection of all other consolations. That's Carl Sagan's viewpoint. This is what the sociologist and philosopher Charles Taylor calls heroic atheism in his book, A Secular Age. As there have been developments in science, there have also been developments in metaphysics and religion. I'm going to mention one and dismiss it. And that is the idea that mathematical tools can be used to prove God's existence. Robert Spitzer's work, New Proofs for the Existence of God, offers an example in its first part. But since he is a philosopher presenting what he regards as a scientific argument, I see this as an internal scientific debate unrelated to religion. And that he's not the only one. Of course, he actually quotes several others. Essentially, they're using what they regard as the need for fine-tuning to create the universe we live in and probability theory to argue that there's a minusculely small probability that there isn't an intelligent creator. Okay, but that really is an argument within science, because that's not a religious argument. Okay. Another approach I'll note and dismiss is what has been called the God of the Gaps approach, allowing religion to speak where science is silent. Apart from the critique of scientism itself, this approach is inherently unstable since it allows an ever-expanding science to define its boundaries. God just gets smaller and smaller in the God of the Gaps theory. A more serious approach, which really arises with Romanticism, is an aesthetic argument for religion as a way of knowing. The poet Ralph Hodgson wrote, "Reason has moons, but moons not hers lie mirrored on the sea, confounding her astronomers, but oh, delighting me." Romanticism as a movement sees art in all its forms, not merely as a way of presenting reality or even the genius of the artist, but as a kind of revelation through which reality discloses itself. Knowing is not merely formulating models of experientially verifiable facts obtained objectively. It is a subjective experience of engaging reality as it speaks the language of aesthetic experience. This kind of aesthetic reasoning typically makes more modest claims than scientism. It acknowledges that nature speaks the language of mathematics, but it also listens for other languages that are spoken through nature. But my focus on this talk will be neither scientism nor aesthetics, but on places where there may actually be a convergence of interests between scientists and theologians with regard to understanding reality as a whole. I should begin by noting, and I know you thought I'd begun, but really I hadn't. That was just the prologue. My old theology teacher, Schubert Ogden, warned me that the reason that most papers never got written was because they never got through the prolegomena explaining the rules by which they would write the paper. But see, my prolegomena was only 2 pages. I need to note at the outset here that there is an observable defensiveness on all sides here. And I've been writing blogs now for about 5 or 6 years, and I tell you the defensiveness comes through in spades. If any of you want to write blogs and get readers, right? One, any blog that gets readers has to say something outrageous at the very beginning. Okay. But there are 2 groups that will bring along readers and pass your blog along if they're offended. And one is atheists, and the other is fundamentalists. If you want your blog read, just take on either one of them. They all have a wide circle of friends. By the way, that's just good commercial advice, right? Most blog things like Patheos pay you if you get enough hits. So just take a shot at atheism or take a shot at Christmas and collect your $50 check for the blog. Okay, there's defensiveness on all sides. The pride of place, once held by philosophers, theologians, and artists, has been displaced by science ever since the 19th century. You only need to look at funding patterns in the academy, business, and government to observe this. The theology school at Southern Methodist University, for which I work, the smallest of the colleges at SMU, has a budget that is less than one of the more minor experiments going on in the engineering school. I would say the engineering school's budget's probably 30 or 40 times ours. Law, not quite the same. Law's having a little problem these days, too. But still, I don't know why it's law and theology that can't get your students. Maybe because neither one pays as well as it promises. But there's a certain defensiveness because the center part of the liberal arts school, at least, has been pushed aside. That's just the reality. Okay. At the same time, scientists are fully aware that they and their work is seriously under attack by a resurgent anti-intellectualism led by people who self-identify as religious and or artistic, and both communities can have a go at science. right, and do. And you can kind of understand it. I mean, the National Endowment for the Humanities, you know, the federal government part of this, that wouldn't fund four offices at the Center of Disease Control. So, yeah, the artists and the theologians. What I hope to do is avoid the defensiveness on both sides. And the way I want to do that is survey briefly perspectives relating religion to science that have arisen in the last 60 or 70 years and the questions they raise, and finally some suggest some avenues through which science and religion may be able to seek a common language for discourse. That is saying, they may kind of speak the same language to each other a little bit. To get on the science side of things, to get where I'm going, I'm going to mention a book co-written by a physicist and colleague, that's Stephen Sekulow, who's been working on the Higgs boson. The title of the book is Reality in the Shadows, or What the Heck is the Higgs? This is a big, thick book in double columns, available on Amazon. For Stephen's sake, I hope you buy it, but honestly, it is the hardest book to read. And believe me, I've read all this stuff, you know, string theory, all the popular books, I've read all this stuff. But it's a collection of independent essays by Stephen and two other guys, and so it's frankly difficult to read, right? Because it just starts and it goes here, and then it picks up here, and it forgets that you didn't attend the lecture that it was based on before. So because of that, after I read the book once, I read it a second time, and I constructed a spreadsheet to trace the major lines of scientific development and identify their interrelationships. I'll share that with you if you'd like it. It's about 25 pages long right now. This allowed me, though, by looking at the spreadsheet, to highlight the themes that get buried when you're jumping all over the place, right? So the categories of science or scientific inquiry that emerge from this book, and I think more generally from reading in this field, one is we have to talk about observation and experiment, things that people have observed, that the sun rises and sets, etc., right? And it gets more complicated. Two, the development of new tools for observing nature and thus new experiments that you can create, right? The astrolab, decent clocks to measure time, and etc. There's a kind of accelerating development of experimental apparatus that allow you to measure things, see things, create things, do things. The third thing is that discoveries emerge then from deploying these new tools. Discoveries that give new information about nature. So someone invents this crook thing called a Crookes tube, a vacuum tube that if you apply electricity to it, something glows, it clearly seems to be emitting light. Oh, now we can experiment on what that light is, right? Then the fourth, and this is often what's forgotten, the evolution of mathematics, both applied and pure. The mathematics that gives scientists the language through which to articulate their theories about the interrelationships of the emerging information about nature. We wouldn't be any place without calculus. Newton could not have described gravity without calculus. Or Leibniz, whoever you want to attribute it to. There's a great set of science fiction novels about that, by the way, called The Baroque Trilogy. Stephen Neal. Anybody know it? Oh my gosh, this is the kind of group that would love his stuff. You must get it. Three big books about the conflict between Newton. Anyway, they're big books. And then it goes from there, right? Set theory, the discovery of symmetry, all of this mathematical theories, ultimately we get multidimensional mathematics that comes up, the discovery of the complex plane, chaos theory, all of it, okay, are critical. Finally, there are the theories themselves, each replacing the last to account for the new information arising from ever more precise experiments and each demanding more complex mathematical tools. Stephen is someone who works on the Large Hadron Collider, and probably the best chapter in the book, and it maybe makes the book worthwhile, is his description of that collider and how it begins. And how, in fact, each of the things that were built before it to smash atoms together is actually still operational. They weren't replaced. Each one just creates the next energy level to feed into the Large Hadron Collider. And that goes back to bubble chambers and stuff like that. But that's actually the best chapter in the book. Okay. Now, of the many stories that emerge in this big, big story that he's trying to tell about the Higgs boson, okay, One of the most central is this. There has been a gradual shift in emphasis in science from experiments that create information that drive the need for new theories, and then new theories that drive the search for mathematical tools to describe what they've seen. Okay? That has been the pattern. And physicists, as new things came along, Einstein's one and others, started reaching back into pure mathematics and saying, whoa, I can use those mathematical tools to describe my theoretical framework. And by the way, then that will yield some testable presuppositions, right? My mathematical description will tell me some things I can test with experiment. So that shift from experiment that drives the need for theories and then theories that seek out the mathematical models has gradually shifted to where we are now, which is mathematical models created abstractly become theories, and the theories are then in search of validation through experiment. And the best example of this is string theory. String theory was not created to explain anything. It happens that it looked like a really good model that might unify relativity and quantum mechanics. Okay, now string theory itself is, you know, there's 25 different kinds of it, but still, it was a theory in search of nature, and finally in search of experiments that might validate it, and it hasn't found any yet, because the dimensions it deals with are really, really tiny, and they're not observable. Assuming there are. In Scientific American this month, one of the articles casually tossed off that as a result of an observation a year and a half ago, confirmed by many sources, oh, well, maybe it will disprove the possibility of multi-dimensions anyway, and we're back to four. The writer of the article seemed very excited about that. I certainly am, because I think string theory is incomprehensible, but I think I might get it if we went back to four. I'm just saying, they could get me back on the same page here. Okay? So, as Steven Weinberg noted in his book Dreams of a Final Theory, also a very good read, physicists have almost become Neoplatonists, believing the abstract mathematical forms to be more real than nature as experimented through experiment. And Weinberg would say that. If we have a beautiful theory, we almost don't care if you can figure out the experiment. It must be real. Right? And that, of course, is not far from theology. By the way, and that's a critique made by scientists themselves, especially with regard to some of the very popular but completely unverifiable theories involving multiverses and undetectable dimensions. Okay, and there are scientists who critique that and say, wow, those theories that fill Scientific American and are so interesting to all of us, is that science anymore? Just because you can draw a cute graphic, I met the guy that does the Scientific American graphics, really good. Just because you can draw a graphic, does that make it real? Now, the internal critique notwithstanding, the reach of complex mathematical models and the related theories seeking to achieve a unification of relativity and quantum theory may offer insight into the intersection between scientific and religious discourse. For they are concerned with this, grasping reality as a whole. They are concerned with a, quote, final theory, close quote, that unifies large and small scale descriptions of the universe. They seek something more than a collection of useful descriptions of reality. Because, by the way, quantum chromodynamics and quantum electrodynamics really work brilliantly well at everything at the atomic level and below. And relativity really works brilliantly well at everything above. And you can do massive amounts of engineering with both of them. Witness my cell phone, okay? Which has a case that's designed according to principles of normal chemistry and physics, but whose innards are entirely dependent on quantum mechanics. Actually, both ways, by the way, because everything down in the core of this little device, as you probably well know, all those integrated circuits and stuff, utterly depend on quantum theory to be constructed. But I've got a GPS in here, and the GPS won't work out without relativity, which tells us exactly how much a signal is delayed in time because of the gravitational field of the Earth between the satellite and the Earth. It's a good example of both the big and the small. Einstein's here, okay? But not just Einstein, all the other guys too. I'm going to rename my phone. Einstein Feynman. Einstein, Bohr. That's not so fortunate.
Heisenberg.
Yeah, Einstein and Heisenberg, right here in one piece. Okay. So, if we now turn from this search for the big, what Stephen Hawking called in his Brief History of Time, and he was certainly being metaphorical, he says, we will find the mind of God. He doesn't really think, I don't think he believed in God. But you know what he meant, right? The mind that grasps reality as a whole. That's what he's looking for. Okay? So now let's turn from that to three broad approaches to justifying religion as a way of knowing reality that might also be of interest to us. And these seek to demonstrate that an a priori assumption of the existence of a transcendent God is rational, coherent assumption, similar to the a priori assumption of cosmologists that nature as a whole can be described within a single theoretical framework. Because since you don't have the framework, if you're working on it, you've a priori assumed it's there. Right? Now, I'm thinking of several recent popular books in particular. Richard Beck's An Authenticity of Faith, Alvin Plantinga's Knowledge and Christian Belief. That's, by the way, the presse of his big monster work in analytic philosophy. Joseph Hinman's Traces of God and Andrew Newberg's How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain. These books argue from different perspectives that human experience, properly and systematically measured and interpreted, strongly indicates that the a priori assumption of the existence of a transcendent God is not only coherent, but offers a credible addition to a scientific description of reality with the goal overall of describing reality as a whole. Now, I can't review all these books this evening, and I wouldn't even want to, but I think they can be characterized. Beck, Hinman, and Newberg use psychological, sociological, and neurological approaches, respectively, to analyze mystic experience, whatever that is. Okay. In them, we see a revival of the work of William James, Rudolf von Otto, Marcus Eliade. I don't know if you know these names, but these are early psychologists and sociologists for religion, especially Marcus Eliade, with this idea of the sacred. Okay. While Beck and Hinman focus on common observation of religious phenomena, the type that sociologists and anthropologists do, Andrew Newberg argues that measurements of brain activity using a variety of brain imaging techniques show that religious practitioners of meditation have a physically unaccounted for change in the structure of their brain. Something happens in their brains that cannot be accounted for, according to Newberg. Okay? What all these approaches assert is that through the working of the human mind, both individually and socially, reality is speaking through through nature in a language that is more religious and theological than it is mathematical. Plantinga's approach is more properly philosophical. He argues that religious belief in general, and Christian belief specifically, is warranted by a careful examination of the way in which the human mind is constructed and articulates its inner working through language. Now, he's a philosopher, right? So he's not like Newberg. He's not doing brain imaging techniques. He's not interested in the brain. He's interested in the mind, if we can make that distinction, okay? His arguments are quite rigorous. They're very complex. It's problematic to represent them in a few sentences. But what he's arguing is that just as the human mind coheres with the natural world that it knows and explores, so the human mind also coheres with the transcendent God in such a way as to suggest that this God exists and has particular attributes. In other words, if the human mind is capable of grasping the language of nature through mathematics, in such a way as to give confidence that what it grasps is real, so its capacity to grasp the language of theology should give confidence that the object of theology, God, is equally real. It should be noted that none of these approaches that I've talked about from a religious standpoint demonstrates the credibility of belief in God claims to constitute a proof of God's existence. None of these writers I've mentioned would say they could prove that God exists. Part of the reason is because I think, from a religious standpoint, a God whose existence can be proven ceases to be God. But we can talk about that later. What they are content to do is to assert that religious speech about God is warranted on terms similar to those that warrant mathematics as the language with which to explore the unity of natural law. Now, where can we go then for positive construction of dialogue between science and religion? Well, I'm going to offer three possibilities. One of these stems from the relationship between revelation and that which is transcendent. Such a discussion would focus on two things that are part of both scientific and religious discourse. One is the beckoning call of the unknowable to be sought out and known. This is something that scientists talk about all the time. It's out there. It's calling at me. I've got to figure it out. I need to know it. And two, the idea of an epiphany in which the unknowable makes itself known without a traceable process of human reasoning. Now, scientism would say we could find that process if we looked hard enough in the neurons. Okay? But in the meantime, right, there's something common to talk about. Like religious people, scientists find themselves caught up in experiences that are described with words like wonder and inspiration, words that even Dawkins uses, A second possibility for mutual discussion stems from a common concern with epistemology, knowing how we know what is true is true. As I've suggested above, Plantinga and others, such as my colleague Billy Abraham, are engaged in the kind of formal exploration of the warrant for believing that abstract representations of reality, comprehensible to the human mind, should be of equal concern to scientists who presently must wrestle with whether complex mathematical models of reality can be taken as actually presenting reality to us, right? When you're off to where you're doing pure complex math of a form that only a dozen people in the world can actually understand. In fact, it can't be done by any one human, right? Big chunks of it have to be done by huge groups of people working together. Then you really do have to begin to wonder, does this touch down with anything that's real? Right? Is there some point at which it matches some experiment that I can imagine doing? And in many cases, it simply doesn't. That's something that Adam Frank would acknowledge, Stephen Sekulow would acknowledge, the others would acknowledge. Doesn't mean they've given up hope, but they're there, right? A third possibility, not unrelated to the other two, stems from a common concern with the relationship between human faith and human meaning. In my own discussion with science-minded atheists, this appears to be the most contentious point of debate, because typically atheists of a scientism bent argue that faith, as commonly understood, plays no role in their understanding of human meaning. Scientists are, they would say, concerned only with what can be observed and placed in the bounded mathematical frameworks. And that's almost like a statement of, oh, faith, right? Yeah, a claim like that has to be based on faith, not accumulated evidence that the comprehensive framework actually exists. And in fact, one of the problems here, a problem that is not seriously raised in the 1930s by Kurt Gödel, but not taken seriously by either enough scientists, although he was a colleague, well, Kurt Gödel was hard to take seriously. He was an unusual individual who, after Einstein managed to get him out of Vienna and into Princeton, only ate baby food all his life. Okay, well, but when you're up here, who cares what you eat, right? Okay, but what Kurt Gödel showed, and I don't believe there's any serious dispute as to his proof, is that there is one statement that no formal system can make about itself. And that is the statement, I am complete. No formal statement. He was, by the way, he was proving this in relation to Whitehead and Russell's Principia Mathematica, okay, which is supposed to close the door on all that. And what he showed was that the Principia Mathematica was not complete because it could not make one true statement. And that statement is, I am complete. Because that statement can only come from outside the system. Okay? So whether we believe in God or deny the existence of anything transcendent at all, we cannot stand outside the framework of explanation we have adopted and declare that it is complete. Thus, at least to the extent that we are seeking a grand unified theory of reality, whether it is expressed in religious dogma or mathematical language, we are living by faith.
Amen.
And this, it seems to me, is closely related to whether the pursuits to which we give our lives are meaningful. The scientists I know are not excited about the reiteration of known truths. You get over that in eighth grade, yeah, proving what everybody else has proven. It is precisely the unknown that animates scientists in their efforts and make those efforts seem worthwhile. The same is, or should be true, of those in the pursuit of religious knowledge. For the God who is fully known through dogma has become unworthy of worship. Thank you very much.
Q&A. Anybody have any questions? I'd like to start by asking you if you'll explain the difference between science and scientism.
Thanks. That's a really good question. So science is a certain pursuit, right? It's a pursuit of knowledge using a certain set of rules that are relatively well known. You create models. You examine reality for what could be regarded as facts. You try to place the facts in relationship, and these are models. You see that aspects of this needs to be tested. You test them by experiment. You come up with new models, and you're continually testing them through experiment. And by the way, then the experiments have to be reproducible and other things. That's science. Okay. Scientism is a relatively new word that has begun to have some popular usage. And it is essentially the claim that science is the only legitimate means of knowing reality. So science is a pursuit that anybody can engage in. Scientism is actually is a claim about the completeness of science as a means of knowing reality.
And that as a corollary, anything that cannot be scientifically examined is not worth knowing.
Yeah, it's not worth knowing because it's not real. I mean, this is kind of an extension of logical positivism. Right? That's the foundation for it. It's Karl Popper's logical positivism.
Yeah. So such things as immortality, the soul, God, are not worth scientific pursuit.
Right. So, you know, so example, the scientist would say, okay, well, let's make God a hypothesis, and now we'll see if it's a testable hypothesis. It's not a testable hypothesis, and it's not. Oh, well, then it's not real. That makes sense? Yeah. Sorry.
I'm basically a skeptic, and I on almost everything. And what I don't really understand is why people are whether they're scientists,
yes.
or religious or anything. Why there is always so much insistence on saying on claiming that they know something when they have no way of really being able to. Demonstrate that. So I guess it's really more about the psychological questions. Why is it so important to claim knowledge of something?
Yeah, that's. I think that is a psychological question, and I'm not a psychologist. I will say this, that I think it's observable in the history of Western society since the Enlightenment, that we move through phases in which people allow themselves to be skeptical and phases in which we do not allow ourselves to be skeptical. It seems that when we are in a strong position, we can be skeptical, you know, when we're relatively confident of who we are and how things are working, we can be skeptical around the deepest edges. And when we begin to lose confidence in that, we become more dogmatic and we allow ourselves less psychological room for skepticism. I will mention that, and I'm not fully aware, haven't read fully enough into it to understand this, but there is, and I mentioned a book to the folks I was sitting with, there's a book by Matthew Crawford called The World Outside Your Head. It's either The World Outside Your Head or The World Outside Your Mind, but I think it's The World Outside Your Head. That is one of a number of books now that is skeptical about Descartesian skepticism. Okay? So it basically is skeptical about whether you begin with skepticism as a way of knowing anything. And that's something fascinating to work out. But yeah, we're now in a post-Enlightenment phase where the assumptions of the Enlightenment that formed the basis for science are now under question. I happen to think that we live in a troubled and anxious age. It doesn't trouble me too much. But in a troubled and anxious age, people tend to not be skeptical. They don't have the psychological strength for skepticism. And so they believe. That's my view. Unprovable, by the way, and untestable. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, it seems like the problem with religion and philosophy in general is it's even though they tried to carefully define words and so forth, it's all based on natural language, which is derived from, you know, experiences and just heaped on more and more commutations and so forth. Whereas mathematics is has been taken as a religion and can be reduced to fundamentals that are all closely related.
Right.
For example, I think the Pythagoreans was a religion, and there was kind of a mystic religion, and you mentioned the Neoplatonists and so forth, was based on fundamental ideas. So, it would be helpful if religion could have sort of get away from these muddy words and so forth and get some kind of concrete language behind it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, and I'm going to complexify it even more for my religious kin. In my life as a scholar, I've had to work not only in English, and I have to qualify that with English learned as a native Texan. For many years, and where I did my degree at the University of Malaya, we worked in Malay, and then a little bit of Chinese, but also I lived in and spoke and worked in German for a long time. And what you realize with these other languages, particularly those that are completely out of the Western context, right, they're not Sanskrit-based, is that the words get even harder. The semantic fields don't overlap exactly. You know, the problem of translation becomes grim. Now, that said, if I could channel my inner Plantinga, or Plantinga, whatever how his name's pronounced, he would say that when philosophers use words, they use them with adequate precision, right? Adequate definitional precision, that they are meaningful and therefore trustworthy. And that they represent not only an adequate language for parts of reality, but the only adequate language. So mathematics just can't go there. Now, if we wanted to go a little bit deeper, though, what we'd have to explore is why, this is a whole other lecture that I gave to the Rotary Club 3 weeks ago, but why do we trust math more than anything else? Well, if you begin with Descartesian skepticism, and I want to actually politicize it. You begin with Descartesian skepticism, right? How do I know anything I know is real, right? And I go back to the fact that I'm a thinking creature. That's at least cogito ergo sum. I know I'm thinking anyway. Right? But then you add a little Lockean political freedom, right? I've got to free my mind from all of the dogmatic things that are telling me the way the world is, because only if I can think freely can I act as a free political actor. So I've really got to be autonomous. I have to have an autonomous epistemology. I have to have a personal confidence in the truth of my own thoughts. Now, how do I test that? Well, one way is I can test them against reality by talking to other people. I can say, did you see that? The external stuff. But internally, what I can do is ask, is it coherent? And that's where the muddy language problem comes in, right? Because all those words have multiple meanings. But I can be absolutely confident of the internal coherence of my thoughts if I can reduce them to mathematical symbols. Right? So then that guarantees that what I know is true. Now, there, that...
Except those mathematical symbols have to be defined.
They have to be defined, and yes.
It can happen at all.
As Carl Sagan points out, the proof of the existence of the number one is 200 pages of symbolic logic.
And each of those symbols are defined in the preamble.
And then you set into another framework, like all of a sudden curved space or something. Oh, and 1 plus 1 doesn't equal 1 anymore. Okay, that's part of all this algebra stuff that you go, but I think we have to ask how we got there and then maybe problematize it, but I can't possibly offer a solution to the problem because the language is muddy. And so for those who are looking for sheer confidence in the coherence of a statement, mathematics absolutely does give it better than natural language. Okay, I think it does. There's other questions. Here and then here. Okay, yeah. Well, I'll take this with me. Okay.
I want to continue that line of thought a little bit.
Okay.
I had a slightly different question. To me, the word unknowable, I've always accepted that it means that it's unlikely to be completely understood in the foreseeable future.
Right.
Which is not an absolute.
Correct.
You seem to mean something more by unknowable when you used it two or three times in your lecture. And if I understand what you were saying, that seems to carry, that word seems to carry inside it its own contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more on what the word unknowable means to you.
Okay, so, I mean, that's also a very excellent question. So let me suggest that there are two possible meanings for unknowables. One would be a commonplace meaning. Okay. There are those things which cannot come to our knowledge in any possible way. And the reason for this would be that, as we know, it's demonstrated by the theory of relativity, because information cannot exceed the speed of light. We each live in what's called a light cone, right? This is part of Hawking's work and others. Everything outside that light cone, the cone of possible information traveled by light, is literally unknowable. It's literally unknowable. It's beyond, most of the universe will never and can never be experienced by any human being. Okay? We only know it because we make a bold assertion, an assumption, which is that the laws that govern the universe are identical everywhere, including the places we can't see and can never see. Without that assumption, science drops like a stone. Okay, but it's not a bad assumption, by the way. It seems to work out every time. Okay. Now, so that's the common sense view of unknowable. The other form of unknowable is unknowable in the sense that even if information could be carried faster than the speed of light, that is to say, so if the whole universe was available to us to know, the particular information would be beyond that universe, that known universe. It would be authentically transcendent. Okay, with transcendent meaning not imminent, not available to be known. So that's the strong use of unknowable as I use it in more than one place. And that's I certainly can't offer a solution. Typically, when theologians speak about revelation, they are speaking of that which is unknowable in the strong sense, making itself known. Right? Not merely human minds finding a place that hadn't been found before. Right? But something from beyond coming in. The problem with saying that the unknowable has spoken into the known world is, of course, that the minute that information is available to our minds, it's part of this world, right? And we can no longer trace it back to the unknowable. But I can't solve that problem tonight. I'm just, you asked for a definition, I'm explaining what it is. Okay? Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, thanks. I guess before I get to this question formulating, am I not talking?
Yeah, that's better, yeah.
First of all, why do people like mathematics that you can make money with it, right?
Yeah.
Really. And, you know, the disparagement of formal logic, well, people are using it in symbols to prove
right.
computer programs. So
exactly.
That's why people like science, because you can make stuff with it. But you're talking about what's knowable and not knowable, right?
Yeah.
And how about Kant with this idea of, you know, we only know what we can observe, and the thing in itself it can never understand, and then, you know, you have Johann Fichte with his Foundations of Science and Knowledge trying, you know, they're wrestling with all these ideas.
Sure.
But we don't hear Kant and Fichte talked about it anymore. Could you kind of explain to us a little bit about where these ideas do have relevance today?
Yeah, okay, so that's a really good question, and I feel compelled to address it from two different sides. Okay. One, within the academy, let's just be perfectly honest, within the academy, Kant and Fichte, the great founders of Enlightenment thought often find themselves squeezed out by concepts that Enlightenment universalism, that is to say, the concept of universal knowledge, right, is offensive to and oppressive of other forms of knowing, particularly those that belong to non-Western culture and ethnic minorities. Okay, so that's a critique of the Enlightenment. You can call it a politically correct critique or whatever, but I can assure you, in my world, you have to take it at least seriously, even if you don't like it. Okay, that's so. One other quick thing. So that's part of it. The other aspect of this has to do with what you can use knowledge for, right? And this is absolutely true. One of the ways in which science has squeezed out theology and religion and the humanities and things like this is that it's so darned utilitarian, right? I mean, just, I love this thing. And you just, not all the theologians in the world could ever build it. Now, on the other hand, interestingly enough, religion is kind of enjoying a big revival. And you, by the way, you can make a lot of money on it, although you usually have to be intellectually dishonest. But that said, there does seem to be a utility in religious thought and thought of God for being a human person that has enduring value. Okay. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, Arthur C. Clarke, some of his novels and others, really widespread, Hardy Cox's Secular City, widespread belief that religion would disappear by the year 2000. It simply wouldn't be credible. It simply wouldn't be useful. In fact, what we find ourselves in is the midst of a religious revival. A statistic, Michael Shermer quoted it, but I've seen it now in two other sources, that's fascinating is, and disconcerting to some, is that in a recent survey, quite a wide survey, 20% of persons who identified themselves as atheists said they believed in a higher power. Wait. So what are they saying, really? Well, I think they're asking another question, right? They're saying something different, which is they're saying, I am an atheist in the sense that I don't believe in God as commonly known. But that doesn't mean I dismiss the possibility of things I don't know. That's my interpretation of data. So, there's more questions. Yeah, here and then here. Right, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I appreciate your level of confidence that both religion and science are faith-based. I agree.
Yeah.
Both use models to get some sort of a grasp or understanding of reality.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how you would distinguish between these two different types of models.
Well, I think the shorthand distinction is that scientific models are provable. Well, scientific models are tested and demonstrable in certain specific ways, and particularly through the use of mathematical theorizing. That say that scientific theories always become mathematical models, or always have since the Enlightenment have become mathematical models. Mathematical models generate results that can then be tested. So I think science is a methodology, and it's quite distinct from religious models, which serious theologians test religious models for internal coherence, right? Insofar as you can specifically define your words and make sure that they have meaning in relationship to each other in more and more complex formulations. So we have to critique each other. But if you ask where the test is, the test is often simply, are they attractive to other human beings whom they help understand reality as a whole better? That is right. The test is, do people look at them and go, I think I know better where I am now because of this religious model than I did before I adopted it? That's not nearly so rigorous as scientific knowledge. But it is a distinctive form of test. Okay, yeah, sorry, back here, and then here again.
Right here first, and then you had asked if it was going for the orbitals, or in fact, it seems like what we could be having occurred is both, where, I mean, you know, like in the same way we're becoming more, the United States become much more politically bifurcated since years ago, where Republicans are really hardcore Republicans, Democrats are really hard Democrats. That in the same way that the people that used to say, yeah, I'm a churchgoer, have become much more fundamentalist. That the
sort of the mainstream denominations, Methodist, Presbyterian, Lutherans, all started waning, and things have shifted way over to the Pentecostal extreme. Whereas, on the other hand, there has been a rise of the nuns, people that literally, if you ask them what kind of religion they believe in, I don't know, they say none.
Yeah.
It seems to me both of those are really happening, and it could actually be that some of the religious fervor is actually the sense, of, just like a scientist, wanting to go back to the manual and say, well, we believe these hard things, not this muddy stuff that you know, and some of these other people believe. We believe in these hard things, in the same way that scientists believe in hard theorems.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking maybe that's what's really going on.
I think that's a fascinating sociological observation. It would take us a lot of time to explore that sociologically and politically. I do think it has a lot to do with identity. And as we feel our identities are under threat, we come back to things that we regard as core to them. And it's explicable in our contemporary social situation in the United States that both scientists and religious people feel their identities are threatened simultaneously. And that will lead to some pulling apart. It also leads to a bigger middle of people who don't feel their identities are very threatened, or at least they're not ready to jump either way to get that identity set, right? They're content. I mean, I don't feel like a millennial, but I actually am not all that worried about my personal identity. So I'm not a nun, obviously, but still, you know, I don't feel the existential anxiety my friends do that are going both ways, but you know what? That's okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I find it interesting. We had one of your colleagues from SMU here a year or two ago to talk about big history. It seems like when history and the religionists feel like they're losing ground, they come up with new ways to sort of work their way back into the conversation. And I would like to talk about your use of coherence, which is a big conversation we can't handle. But I have a couple of questions. I'm trying to get this down to a simple point. Were any religionists, not science, not what you would call scientists,
yeah,
that worked Alamogordo, that developed the atomic bomb, that I think we would all agree did blow up? Did they invite anyone?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How about, you know, recently, just this month, the company that's the major producer of DNA sequencers,
yeah,
has come up with a desktop version.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm kind of curious if you know of anyone with a religion or philosophy background that helped with the creation or invention of, and was what they used to invent that, you know, some mystical thing out there.
I can't imagine that anybody with a theology PhD would be remotely qualified to work on that.
So, I'm kind of curious why you think that it would be even a worthwhile pursuit for the religionists and the scientists who obviously contribute to... I'm a cancer survivor, and I'm really glad that the surgeon went to a legitimate medical school with scientific training, because I'm here 15 years later to ask you these stupid questions tonight. But... you know, so I'm really kind of curious as to, you know, why would these people be interested in talking to you? Have you spoken to a physics conference or a chemistry conference or to a biology conference about your ideas?
Oh, okay. Well, that's actually a second question, and the answer is there are some. I mean, I'm having dinner in a couple of weeks with two of the people that are working on the Higgs boson, and they want to talk about religion. So that's their personal matter.
Okay.
Now. But they don't want to ask me about the Higgs.
Of course not.
Okay, they know I have some real questions for them, but I don't have any questions about that.
Awesome.
So that and there is a large it's always difficult. There's a big grant giving group called the Templeton Foundation that's interested in the intersection of science and religion, but the presence of large amounts of money always distorts conversation. So I'm not going to
Well, one of their projects that they funded failed miserably. I mean, they have a religious orientation.
Right. Certainly. Well, at least mystical. But, okay, that said, I don't think we should believe that the... let's go back a second. One of the efforts for religious people to engage in scientific discussion was to say, look, you guys do great on material creation of things, curing cancer, all of this stuff, but you don't do all that well on human meaning. Okay? And that's our theme. We do that really well. Now, I will say, I have a problem with that argument. I think it goes fairly far. But the scientists I know who are not religious find their lives meaningful. Right? That's just a pragmatic thing. Whether they should find them meaningful, we can interrogate. But they seem to be doing okay. Right? They're not waking up in the morning going, oh my gosh. Okay? They don't have an existential question that a religious person can answer. The problem is on the other side, there's lots of religious people who don't have any scientific questions. They like the stuff, but they're not, you know, whether there's a grand unified theory or not makes no difference to them.
Right.
And that's why I say starting a conversation has to look for some place where there is actually a common concern. My theology professor, Schubert Ogden, would have said, there's no point in talking. Religion and science deal with two different domains. Each is magisterial. Neither overlaps. Therefore, we shouldn't have any conversation. What it seems to me has emerged in the last 15 years of discourse on both sides is that scientists are, in fact, asking some of the kinds of questions, especially in cosmology, that philosophers and religious people have traditionally asked. Okay? And religious people are having to confront the fact that science is moving into domains where they assumed they had room. Okay? And because of that overlap, that's why I say there may be some language about revelation, transcendence, faith, meaning, may have some language, which if carefully teased out in conversation, might prove to be beneficial. But I don't think religious people are going to help scientists along, and vice versa. Now, that said, our theology faculty was invited by the Research Institute at the University of Methodist Hospital, by its head, 2 years ago to come down and listen to their research. And the reason was precisely because in a number of different things that have to do with what does it mean to be a human being, their research was moving into areas where they did not find scientific answers readily available. Okay? And so they actually wanted to talk to people who thought a lot about what it means to be a human being in non-biological terms. So that's... Now, I will tell you, and I don't want to speak too much, out of school here, but the scientists were way more interested in the conversation than my fellow theologians were. I think we were the ones who wanted to talk in our own little world. And I think part of that is because we would have had to learn a whole lot of biological science in order to engage meaningfully with the questions they were asking. So,
thank you.
Okay, does that help? I mean, it doesn't help, but it at least gives you an answer.
I'm just curious what your answer
would be.
I'm going to thank you for answering my question before I even asked it.
Oh.
Because the whole proposition is science and religion are opposites. Uh-huh. Okay, they're opposed to each other. And I think you can't be wholly human unless you own both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you need both of those to make you, plus other stuff.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. That's it. Stay. And the end.
One more question. where we're going to find a real interface between science and philosophy is artificial intelligence. As we, get these things to become, quote, conscious, we're going to get ethical conundrums, good and bad. How are we going to teach them ethics? Do they have a soul? That sort of thing, we're going to get, we can't answer these questions now, but they're going to, maybe you can help a little bit.
Well, all I can say is the questions will come, and they may be you know, we always say, well, it'll be next year, but, you know, I didn't think we'd be where we are. You know, Isaac Asimov in his Foundation trilogy thought the idea that you could carry around a vast amount of information in a small box was often some distant future when we conquered the galaxies, and, whoa, I already got this thing.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I mean, I did Fortran programming in between college and high school and college out of what became UTD, was the Southwest Research Institute, working on a particular problem in analyzing satellite data, you know, where we turned in punch cards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Fortran, remember that?
Yeah.
Fortran,
yeah.
The scientific programming language.
They had to use Python. Okay.
Yeah, okay. And, so this is more powerful than that huge computer in a room with its gods and goddesses that we had to pass things to. So things are going to always happen to us faster. One of the scientists down in Houston told us, if you want to think about something, realize that the question is not if. The question is only when in the next 10 years will we do a brain and spinal cord transplant.
Absolutely.
So that's absolutely on the horizon. We're thinking about that already. We're worrying about the surgical procedures and setting them up so when the time comes, we can do it. So I think those problems are going to happen faster than we think, and they necessitate a little bit deeper level of conversation, if only for this reason. For better or worse, the majority of our American population does less and less understands what science is and how science works. And this is why I'm working with Stephen on his book. I'm encouraging him to rewrite it, because I'm going, at some point, I know people try to popularize it, right? But I read all the popular books. Physicists are not great communicators. Even the best ones are not great. And so at some point, we need a conversation that blows out of the scientific realm into the public realm, and it may be that there need to be mediators who sit somewhere between, I would say.
Some are better than others, like yourself. Well,